I'm in Larry's office in the basement, so it's like a... It's a special space.
Is this where Larry sleeps?
This is the very window, in fact. This is where Bryson sleeps, but this is the very window, in fact, that got broken into many Christmases ago, where we were in Hawaii and got the call that someone had broken into the Denver house, but then they didn't steal anything and left, and we were laughing because the basement's so messy that we decided that they came in and they were like, oh, this house has already been hit.
Nope. Somebody else got
it. They just thought it had been hit, yeah. They were like, oh, this place is trashed. I'm out.
Oh, Justine put her dog down, and it was very sad. It was very hard. Bless you. It was really hard, but the I don't want to say the fun part, but the kind of beautiful thing was
fun part.
The before, I went over to her house to have, you know, it was his last night, Toby's last night, and our other friend John and the three of us lived together when she got Toby, and it had been 14 years since, or 13 years, 13 and a half years. And there was something really special about the three of us being together and saying goodbye to Toby. It was very sweet. It was really nice to be with these people who I love and have such like core memories with of my time in New York.
Yeah.
It was good. Is there anything else to talk about, really, though?
Sure. I mean, I went to a Renaissance fair.
What?
It was very weird.
Tell me.
It was great. You can't imagine the lengths that Colorado goes to for this Renaissance festival. It's a huge...
Oh, I do. I do know. It's massive.
It's massive. It's a castle, and you walk in, it looks like Disney World. It's like everything's designed to the craziest degree. Everyone's in character. Everyone's in costume, including the people that got tickets to go.
Did you go in costume?
No, I ate a sausage on a stick.
Did Griffin wear his prince?
Oh, no, I wish I brought it, though. He was, like, really feeling himself. That's his time period. So he was there, and he was like, this is great. He loved the sausage on a stick. He loved watching some jousting. We went and watched a bunch of... We watched a clowning show, and Cole got called from the audience for a really cool fire show that he got to participate in.
Oh, my God.
It was great. And I think it was that day I was listening to a podcast and learned something interesting that was that fear sweat smells different from workout sweat. You knew that?
I did.
And that's what your blink is. So your blink is literally like, imagine someone's about to do something to you. They're going to be like, if they're not a complete disconnected sociopath, they will have some anxiety about what they're about to do, and they'll be sweating, and they'll be emitting a pheromone that is like, I'm about to do something weird. And if they're not, if they're just running, they're not going to emit that pheromone. So like, if you pick up on like a weird sense, probably it's because you're smelling that something is about to happen. Isn't that wild?
The animal brain that we've got on us is miraculous.
Yeah, I was like, I never really made that connection. And then I was like, oh.
Of course.
Yeah. So I was into that.
Oh, I'm really into that.
That's your blink, baby. Wow. I took my first week of IFS training.
Oh, how'd it go?
Which was super cool. I loved it.
When you're in these training sessions or like learning, how much of your social work degree do you feel like you're like applying it to yourself? Like how much of it, like, because I mean, in the practical, like in learning about it, right? Like, is there ways to apply it?
It's extremely applicable in the sense that the structure of learning in this community is that we would like get together in the morning and meditate together. Then they would do a lecture series on an element of IFS. Then they would take questions. Then they would often demo it on a volunteer because you're in a room with, trained practitioners. So they would do a session where we'd all turn off our screens except the person who's essentially receiving IFS therapy. We would watch it, then we'd ask more questions, then we'd go into smaller breakout rooms, and in those breakout rooms, we would be taking turns receiving IFS therapy from a student of IFS and giving IFS therapy to a student. So we're all therapist and clinician, and it's like cyclical, and we're all getting to be both.
Quinn, I'm saying this with love, and I know it's not a cult, but hearing you say IFS that many times does feel weirdly culty, but
yeah, it's a little culty.
So I mean, fun. I mean, like that's so cool. So is this your favorite education you've had thus far in your training?
For sure.
Do you think next year is going to be kind of like this, where you're going to be doing like more hands-on?
Yeah, like I'm taking a class in trauma, and I really like my diagnostics class that I took this summer. Like, it's definitely like any college degree, the first part is the basics. Yeah. So it's less specifically applicable to what I would want to be doing, because right, it's an overview and they don't know what I want to be doing. Yeah. They're trying to teach to everyone for a million different disciplines. Yeah. So the more specific it starts to get, the longer you're in school, the more interesting. And I also just think that in terms of wanting to go into a therapeutic practice, it's now I'm in a position where I'm in charge of my own education, where of course I need this social work degree, but then what am I really interested in as far as
the path you want to take, sort of like the way you want to practice.
And then that's really exciting, because you start to really get to pick all these things, and yeah, I'm really liking that.
Is it when you come home to see your family after taking these classes, like, do you see things that you...
Totally. It's more just hysterical that the way that I speak is
you're stilted changing
for
now,
like an afternoon where I'm like, I'll be like, I really want spaghetti for dinner, and that's just something that I need to name. I just need to name it in this space. Like, what?
And I think it's
you're like, I just
actually
had to say it.
I need to name it. I just want to name it.
It reminds me of Lucy's daughter, Dorothy, who used to be like, do you want to know my truth? And then she would tell a story about like a triceratops, but she was like three and she'd go, you want to know my truth? It's like, yes, I do.
You know, therapy speak is really good when it's not weaponized, but I really like it. I like that. I like therapy speak. It just seems, I just think that's so fun.
I will tell you one really funny thing that happened, which was that in a small breakout group, the first day we were having to introduce ourselves, and I had so much anxiety, and I told a story to them, to the tiny breakout group I was in, because it's, you know, we're in a big room of like 50 people. We go in these small rooms of like six. And I was telling them, you know, I remember that in high school, I had just switched schools and I was new to the school. And on the first day of ninth grade, I was in a classroom where we were having to go around the room and say our name and introduce ourselves in a band that we liked. And I was so nervous that I wouldn't be able to think of a band that in my head I was like, just say Cranberries. You like the Cranberries. And then I was repeating in my head, not listening to anybody in the room essentially, and being like, Cranberries. You're just going to say Cranberries. It's not a big deal. Just say Cranberries. Cranberries. It's fine. And then the guy right before me introduced himself and said, I like anything but the Cranberries. A bunch of bald yodeling ladies. And everybody in the room laughed, and I could not think of a band. I was like, oh my fucking God.
No.
And
that's so mean.
I told this story, and no kidding, they play music at the beginning of the day when we're like getting into the space before we do our meditation. And the next day, guess what they played? Cranberries. They played it all day, every time we were in a transition. And I was like, I feel seen. I feel repaired. I feel loved. I feel honored.
Wow. And do you think they did that intentionally?
1,000%.
That's really sweet.
Yeah.
They're healing. Hey, we're healing.
Yeah,
we're healing. We're learning. We're healing. We're healing. And we're healing. Wow. So good news for my lunch tomorrow at work is my friend's not going to be there. So he got me an extra lunch. So I got dinner tomorrow night. Really exciting. Really. I'm hungover. How am I going to go on this date tonight to a cocktail bar? I just got a rally, right?
Yeah, you got to take a psilocybin gummy.
I should go on mushrooms to this fucking date. Hi.
Hey.
So good to see you.
You're beautiful.
What's funny about this guy is I matched with him and he no longer appears on my matches, so I don't know what happened. So I can't look at him to see what he really looks like or get any information anymore. But he texted me and he's like, we're still on for tonight? And I was like, yeah.
He's so confident it's going to work out that he took his profile down. I think he's going to kill you now that I think about it, because I can't figure why he would take the profile down otherwise.
I just feel like it's important to note that, like, I could die at any time.
Where are you meeting him?
I'm meeting
public spaces.
No, I'm going to his house.
Remember, there was
he lives in a basement.
There was a friend of mine. Was it Jamila this happened to? That was matched. Maybe I've told you this. Matched with a guy online that wanted to meet her in a park in the middle of the night or something.
Oh, I remember this.
And then she was like, you know, my mom would be so disappointed in me if I did something that dopey. And then he lost it on her in a really mean, crazy way. And I was like, oh my God, he was going to kill you.
We love when they tell on themselves. This guy, I think he's older. He grew up where my ex grew up, which it's okay. He's older than him, so I'm not worried. But yeah, we're meeting at a cocktail bar in the East Village.
Fun. Sure. Which one?
Super Bueno.
I don't know. That sounds familiar.
It's in his basement. There's no windows. And he said I should bring my own handcuffs. That's good luck. Fun. That's fun, right? That's yeah, mom. You hear that?
You're party animal.
Well, I was supposed to go on a date the other day, and I was supposed to do back-to-back dates. I was going to do a two in one day. Do you think that's a wise decision?
Yes. It's just a different form of speed dating, but more focused.
I know. Okay. It ended up not working out, but honestly, all I'm going to be talking about are my dates. I hope you're fucking locked in and hope you're ready.
Locked
for
and
it.
Loaded,
I
baby.
Hope you're rocked and loaded. Rocked and loaded and divine to crime. Okay, you should tell a story now.
Sure.
By the way, you're listening to Truly
Darkly
Creeply.
This is a story from our friend Skip.
Wait, let's pause.
Oh.
You know that feeling when your day finally slows down and you just want to relax, unplug, and feel good? That's where Mood.com comes in. They're changing the game, delivering legal THC products right to your door, no shady dealers, and absolutely no medical card required, just good vibes and better sleep, shipped straight from their farm to your couch. From delicious THC gummies, smooth vape pens, to premium THC flower, Mood has it all. And everything's federally legal under the 2018 Farm Bill. Yeah, this isn't some loophole. It's the real deal. Head to Mood.com and use code FIRST20 for 20% off your first order. That's MOOD.com. Find your mood.
This
you look so scared. Ah!
This is from Skip.
Hi, Skip.
Skip Hollinsworth, we love you.
We love Skip Hollinsworth from Texas Monthly.
This is a 1982 situation. This story starts, I just want to tell you a little bit about the character of Brenda, who her dad was a factory worker in central Mexico and was like, we can have a better life. Let's go to Dallas and move to this community. I can do construction. Mom can clean houses. They have five kids. Brenda's the only daughter, and she wants to go to medical school, but they don't come from a lot, and it's very expensive. She's living at home. She takes a second job. And meanwhile, she is growing up on the dating apps like you, Carrie. And
get out there, girlfriend.
Around 30, she meets this guy, Ricky, who she starts to go out with. She's 31, he's 38. And she is a student, a dental hygiene student at Sanford Brown College in Dallas. She did it. And Ricky, her boyfriend, is a graduate of Stanford Medical School. He came to Dallas to complete a residency in dermatology. Then he became assistant professor. He's really sweet guy. And he had already been married. When they start dating, he's divorced. In August of 2012 is when they start going out, and they're only together a few months when they move in together. It's fast. Quick. I think there was a reason behind it, not like we're ready to move in, but something happened where she needed to. I can't remember.
Rent is cheaper.
They're very close in this relationship. It's they do everything together. They're together for a couple of years. During that time, Brenda gets pregnant. They talk about it together, and it is decided she will have an abortion. She doesn't tell her family about that. She keeps it very private, but we do know that she has, maybe it's in notes or something. I don't know where she takes, it's like journaling in your phone. She puts somewhere how upset she is about having had the abortion and that one day she and Ricky will have a child. Mm-hmm. And it's just now's not the time, but she really wants that with him. Okay. Like I told you, Brenda is a student in this dental hygiene program at Sanford Brown. And one of her classmates remembers that when they all had to, speaking of going around in a circle and introducing yourself, when they have to do that, she, instead of talking about herself, she just talks about her boyfriend, you know? Mm-hmm. Like she just one of those that's like, let me tell you though.
Let me tell you about myself. I'm dating a doctor.
Yeah.
And he's so great.
Yeah. So now we're in 2014. She's wearing a promise ring and she takes Ricky to meet her relatives in Mexico. But shortly after this, he breaks up with her and she's totally devastated. She's not doing well in school now. She even withdraws. And Ricky is okay. He's not, you know, he decided to break up with her. So he's
doing great.
He signed up for salsa classes. That's where he's at. Right. One night, she happens to be at the salsa studio, also taking a class. And he's like, ah! And they're doing that thing where you walk around the room and dance with everybody. And they end up dancing together. And there's a little, like, spark and a little rekindle and a little... Oh. They start kind of seeing each other again, slower. Don't move in together, but it's a little bit of a thing. And I think that happens for around a year, but doesn't really take full flame. He ends it again. And they're just friends. So they're in touch here and there. How you doing? And that kind of thing. He goes running.
How you doing?
Good. He'll go on runs on this particular trail and he'll often see her, I guess, when he's running, which he's like, huh, what a coincidence.
And then love these coincidences.
It's a lot of coincidences. Are not
feeling
safe. And then it gets really coinky dink heavy when he is at a Panera Bread on a date and she comes to the Panera Bread and he's like, this is heavy coincidence. Obviously, Brenda is not like, let's just spoiler alert it quicker than later. She's keeping tabs on him through apps. Somehow she knows his passwords and she's in his email. She's in his stuff. She knows where he's going. She's also knows the location of his cell. So she can just find him. So she's low-key stalking him.
That's not low-key. That's high-key. That's like she's fully
She's stalking him. But he doesn't know. It's like for him, she's like, stalking him, but he's not like, oh, no, it's because she's stalking him in that way where every time she's somewhere, she's like, oh, hey, not like she doesn't like throw a dead rabbit at him. You know, she's like, and oh, my God,
hey,
how are you?
Let this be a little lesson for those of you who are interested in stalking. Don't bring a dead rabbit. Go and act surprised.
Right. So he's dating people. She's taking screenshots of his plans and she's on it.
What's the end game here, guys? What's the end game?
It's such a good question. Like any jilted lover, she just wants back in the game. But unfortunately for her, he does end up starting to date Kendra Hatcher, who's a 35-year-old pediatric dentist. Everybody be a dentist in this group. And she was like captain of the cheerleading, volleyball, basketball, whatever. She did everything. Mm-hmm. She's cool. Not only is she cool, but she's kind. She's somebody that would fly on trips to help build churches for kids in low-income countries. It's like very...
There's just so many things you just said. I don't know.
I'm just listing words.
She would get on a plane and she would She'd go get on airplanes. To a place and build a thing for people who want that thing who in the place the thing. That she flew to just for
She's
that.
A Habitat for Humanity
Great.
Person.
Great.
And, here's one. She traveled to Ecuador to perform free dental work on kids. She's just given back all the time. She's wonderful.
Yeah. My friend like, is actually truly, doing that. Next
she's
year.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, she's truly like a gem of a person. Super kind, super caring.
Better than
Walter. And you don't meet a lot of captain of the girls' volleyball team and cheerleading squad that run around doing also so much good in the world. Yeah. So she's just 100% the best. He knows that. Like Ricky's like, this is it. This is the woman.
Yeah.
So he feels like he wants to also just let Brenda know in this way where they're friends and he's like, I met someone and this is kind of where it's headed. From his perspective, Brenda takes it really well and is like, hey, congratulations. But of course, we know better. We know that Brenda is trolling the interwebs, looking for everything she can on Kendra, taking screenshots of it. She's going on dates with other people. And during the dates, much like how she introduced herself by talking about Ricky, she now introduces herself on dates by talking about Ricky and Kendra and then saying, do you want to leave this restaurant and just drive to Kendra's house and watch her through the
does
window?
This, can I ask just because inquiring my, does this work for her? Is this something to sort of adopt?
Yeah, I think guys are really into it.
Noted. Cool.
Meanwhile, Ricky and Kendra, things are going really well. They're going on trips together. They're about to head to Cancun for the weekend. And things are really positive. Like, it seems like it's headed towards getting more serious. The day before they're meant to take this trip to Cancun, Kendra is killed. Somebody shoots her in the head in the parking garage of her building. Her purse is missing, so when the police arrive, the first thing they think is it might be robbery, but within a week of looking at all the evidence, they're like, it's Brenda, and her family's like, no fucking way. She was totally a normal person. She's not a murderer, and even Ricky is like, that doesn't add up. She was really friendly to me about everything. I don't see it being her either, but when they start looking through the evidence they can get, what it like the tech evidence? That's not what I want to say.
The forensic evidence of the technology that she was using.
Like that kind of stuff. They're like, and they just start talking to people that saw her recently and they start to build out the story of what took place. There was a guy that went to high school with Brenda Milton who went out to dinner with her. And during the dinner, she just, like we said, she talked about what she loves to talk about. Ricky and Kendra.
Oy.
And she says to him, do you know anybody that could hurt someone? And he's like, what? She's like, yeah. And he's like, listen, whatever you're thinking
These
about doing
people man
please don't do it. And so she's like, never mind, I gotta go. She goes and meets her cousin Moses, and when she meets him, she has a bat with her, and she tells him, I'll buy you a car or I'll pay your child support if you threaten this woman. And he's like, what do you mean? And she's like, oh, I just want to scare her. And he's like, I'm out. Goodbye. Then Brenda has this friend named Jennifer who had a recent breakup, so moves in with Brenda. And while living with Brenda, Brenda won't stop about the Kendra and Ricky stuff. And she again is like, what do you want? You want drugs? You want a car? What can I do for you to make your life easier? And she's like, what exactly do you want to do to these people? And she's like, well, I'm glad you asked. And it's already heightened. Like the request from when she talked, she's like asking people to scare Kendra. And now it's, I want to take a bat and I want to put Ricky in a coma and I want to kill Kendra by stabbing her with a hypodermic needle or maybe beating her to death. I'm not sure. Jennifer's like, I'm going to move out. So she does, but
Are any of these people going to the police and being like, we're worried about?
No.
Okay. Well, let's all take a
only
lesson.
After the fact.
A little too late. Okay.
I think they're just running away from Brenda. And I think a lot of them maybe don't take her seriously. I'm not sure why. What then happens is that a woman that Jennifer knew and introduced Brenda to, Crystal, she'd come to see Jennifer when Jennifer was living with Brenda. So Brenda knows her. And Crystal is in a more desperate place. First of all, she is like, okay, Brenda has her life together. She has this place. She has all this nice stuff. I don't have a lot of money. I'm a single mom. So Brenda starts buying Crystal, like taking Crystal, wining and dining her and being like, hey, I really need this to get this woman, Kendra, out of my life. Do you want to help? I'll give you $500. And Crystal's like, yeah, I'll help you. So she's like, okay, what should we do? And they quickly realize they don't know what they're doing. And Brenda's like, what we need is a hitman. Do you know where we could hire a hitman? And Crystal's like, well, I'm from a neighborhood where there's a couple people we can ask. Let's talk to this neighbor of mine, Christopher Love. Let's have him over. So Christopher brings his kids over, who jump on Brenda's trampoline while they have this conversation about murder. And he's like, this is great for me. I'm an entrepreneur. I want to start a prostitution ring, and I do need a lot of money to start that. So
don't say he's an entrepreneur. That's so stupid. I'm sorry. That's so stupid.
He's got big dreams.
That got me. I'm sorry. It's so not funny.
He's got big dreams. And he's like, God. What do you know? And Brenda talks a big game because she thinks like she can't just like be like, I'm just this woman that wants to kill this other woman. So she's like, I'm actually super connected to the cartel. And I can get you drugs. I can get you money. I'm very connected. You just need to do this, like kill this woman. And meanwhile, feels like she's on a ticking clock because Ricky's telling her he's selling his furniture. She's like, this guy's getting ready to like move somewhere with this woman. We got to do this thing. But she puts it all on Crystal and Christopher because obviously she knows she can't have her hands dirty. So the day that Kendra's murdered, we know that Crystal and Christopher are stalking her at her work. They're watching her. Brenda has borrowed a car from a friend to give them to use, and they're following Kendra around, and it is Christopher that pulls the trigger when they're in Kendra's parking garage. Like I said, Brenda makes sure that she's with somebody at a Chili's and can account for where she was during the murder. But she does call Crystal that night to be like, did it happen? Yes. And she takes Kendra's purse as sort of proof of death, I guess. Mm-hmm. And the homicide detective has nothing to go off of. He just has a little bit of video of this black Jeep in the parking garage. So what happens is that they put the Jeep on the news. The guy who owns the Jeep, who lent it to Brenda, sees it on the news and is like, what? That's my car. So he calls Brenda and is like, what? Did you kill someone? My car is attached to this murder. And she's like, no, I lent it to my friend Crystal, who she is trouble, who knows what she got into.
Oh my God. First of all, that's just tacky.
Well,
if you borrow a car and then you lend it to somebody else, that is not nice.
It's not nice. And luckily, this guy is not, he knows he's in trouble. So he calls the police right away and is like, that's my car. But I wasn't in it. Here's the situation. So then they bring Brenda in and interrogate her for a few hours. And she's like, what are you talking about? I didn't even care that he broke up with me. She's being very
evasive.
Yeah, but also like trying to paint a picture of like, I don't even think about that guy. Then they bring Crystal in, who is not as good at, like, I think Brenda's very good at lying and Crystal's not. Yeah. Crystal tells a story about how she keeps changing her story, first of all, but in general, she tells this tale about an imaginary man named Lamar who forced her to be with him at gunpoint and was the person that killed Kendra, but that she was at gunpoint. And then she's like, actually, it was a robbery and Brenda paid me and Lamar to do the robbery, but I didn't know he was going to shoot this woman when we were robbing her. And then I just drove away because he had a gun. I was in danger. So with this new information, the detective will go back and try again to get Brenda to admit to it. Brenda's a tough cookie. She's not doing that. So they have to let her go. They don't actually have enough on her. They do on Crystal. So they can arrest her. And then they learn through her phone records, there's no Lamar. The person that you were with was this Christopher Love. They search his car. They find the gun. Now they have Christopher. Now they have Crystal. Now they have to go back and be like, these two people have no ties to this woman, Kendra. What they do have a tie to is Brenda. Brenda obviously hired them to do this. But she's fled by that time. She's fled to Mexico. So she gets put on...
America's Most Wanted.
Yeah, the FBI's Most Wanted list. Yeah. And they're looking for her. They track her. They find her in Mexico. But the law in Mexico is we won't let you extradite her if you're going to seek the death penalty. So they have to, the Dallas DA has to be like, we're not going to seek the death penalty, or we're going to ask that she not be sentenced to death at the sentencing. Crystal makes a deal where she'll take a 35-year sentence in return for her testimony.
Wow.
So she'll basically talk and she'll expose Christopher. She'll expose Brenda. Yeah. She says of the whole affair that she was just young and simple-minded and got caught up in the excitement, which is a horrible thing to say, by the way. The excitement of killing this woman who
did nothing,
is flying to Ecuador to help kids there. Like, it's mind-boggling. Also,
you don't know this, like, you took a life. That's, I don't know how much of a, like, I was just in love. I don't, that's.
And no. Like, in love with what? This woman you didn't know at all that was like, help me kill this woman I'm jealous of? It's so pathetic. It's so upsetting.
Well, she got 35 years.
Yeah. And with her, so with her testimony, they do seek the death penalty for Christopher Love. And he is found guilty and he is sentenced to death by lethal injection.
What about Brenda?
Brenda, her trial. They took 20 minutes to find her guilty for capital murder, and she was sentenced to life in prison without parole.
Great. Okay. Because Chris Love wasn't in Mexico, right?
Chris Love was just around. He was busy trying to start his...
Her going to Mexico saved her life, probably. Did Chris Love die yet? Is he gone?
I'm not sure.
I don't love the death penalty.
I don't love the death penalty either.
I also am like, you know, the person who made this all happen is Brenda.
Yeah, and for what? Like, you just can't.
She took a life of it. And like, what is the end? Again,
so mentally ill to delude herself to think, like, if Kendra's out of the picture, it's me. Like, it just doesn't seem like that was true either. It's, and this, like, innocent woman that did nothing but date this guy and was such a good person, and they just killed her. It was, I don't know. Skip Hollandsworth writes a really good article on it. It's so got way great. More information than what I did today. I'm just like here to summarize. But yeah, it was just such a sad article where you were like, what? But what drew me to it from the beginning was I was like, another article about a killer dentist.
Because we've covered killer dentists before.
Yes.
It's just such a waste. It's such a waste, this these stories of like, jilted lovers who, I mean, what's crazy too is like, it feels, it's just, what a waste in that poor family.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I'll stay single. I think that's the only answer at this point.
Yeah,
I think that's it.
We're talking ourselves into it.
Yeah, you kind of, it's harder for you, to be fair.
To be single? I can do it.
You committed. But you committed. You're not going to be single for at least another... Those kids are around, you know. You'll never be single again.
Jesus, Gary. Are you daring me?
Yeah,
sounds like you're daring me.
Red I'll Rover, do it. Red Rover, send a married person on over. It's my turn. I got this information from Wikipedia, history.com, BBC, ABC. I'm taking you back to October 25th, 1994. Where were you?
Ooh, great question. 94. I was 11 years old. I guess that's fifth grade.
Mm-hmm.
What, and do you remember your Halloween costume? My teacher said the word squirrel, like squirrel.
Squirrel?
Squirrel.
Squirrel.
And
squirrel.
She separated us into boys and girls to talk about sex ed stuff, but like mostly just how to put in a tampon. I wonder what she said to the boys. So awkward. It's already awkward to be girl on girl and her talking about tampons. I just always wonder, like, what did she say to them?
You're saying girl on girl when you're 11 years old. It's so awkward to be girl on girl. Yeah, what were you doing in this fucking class, Quinn? That's concerning me.
What was going on?
You're like, are you looking up what the sex education is in fifth grade in Colorado? For you're like, what?
Yeah, I'm like,
I bet it's boners. Been? I bet it's, you know what it is, I bet? Because I think
but
I know exactly.
She did not talk to them about
no,
that.
No, no, no. That's I think so I know exactly awkward. What it is. Like hair and deodorant. I guarantee you that's what she talked to the boys about. Because she was like, hello, boys. You're all smelling. Please wear deodorant.
Please.
Girls. Girls? Did she say girls? She said squirrels? No. Girls?
I don't, why did, and it was a song that she would sing. She'd go, squirrel, squirrel, shake your bushy tail. Squirrel, squirrel, shake your bushy tail. Wrinkle up your little nose, put your head between your toes. Squirrel, squirrel, shake your bushy tail.
Was she from?
But why? We were in fifth grade. That's too old for that. That's like a preschool thing. The more I think about this teacher, the more questions I have.
It's all making sense now. I was in kindergarten and I probably was receiving a more nuanced education than you were at that age. I don't, we were learning letters, okay? We were learning the letter people.
Don't
we
brag. Those,
yeah. I mean, no, I'll brag all day about Mrs. Winfield, who I think looks the exact same as she did when I was a child. She's had the same haircut. And I know this because she came and saw One Woman Sex in the City, which scarred both of us, to be fair.
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, she taught me when I was 5, and then I'm like, my legs are above my head while I'm talking about fellatio. I don't know if that's what she's like, oh, I'm so proud of little Carrie Ipama. Like, what did this little girl do?
But I bet she was.
It was weird. I was like, my whole, 4 of my teachers from elementary school. Anyway, let's stop talking about that. Okay. October 25th, 1994, the police get a frantic call from 23-year-old South Carolina resident Susan Smith. She is on the phone with the police, and she is frantic. She's saying that she was driving her 1990 Mazda Protege sedan with her 2 young kids in the backseat,
mm-hmm.
her 3-year-old son Michael and her 1-year-old son Alexander.
Mm-hmm.
She is suddenly approached in her vehicle by a black man. He points the gun at her. He makes her get out of the car. She pleads for her kids, but the man gets in the car and drives away. Her kids are gone. Her car is gone. She's calling the police, and immediately there's a massive manhunt underway. She does a sketch of the assailant, and they're searching for the car. This gets picked up by the media. These 2 kids, they're just searching everywhere. Have you seen this car? Where is this car? Please let us know. This manhunt goes from local to national news. It is a media circus. She is put in front of the camera with her husband, and she is begging and pleading for whoever took her kids to please return them to safety. The police are, of course, searching for these missing kids in this missing car.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also trying to cover all of their bases. So they're looking at nearby lakes and ponds to see if something happened. They're doing searches, and they find that they said that they believe that the if there was any sort of evidence, it would be within 30 feet of the shore. And a couple days in, they think that she's not telling them enough information, or that there's more information that she's not sharing with them.
Mm-hmm.
And so they keep her very close, 1 for information, 2 to appeal to the media, and also because keep enemies close. So 2 days after the kids go missing, she takes a polygraph test. There's a significant breakthrough in the case with her description of the carjacking location. She claims that she was at a traffic light that turned red, which causes her to stop at this empty intersection. However, it was later determined that the only way that this intersection would change colors is if there was a car present on the intersecting road. Do you know about, you know, those certain stoplights that are not timed? They're based on if there's a car there or not.
No, but that makes sense.
Yeah. So some stop, like if it's a really busy street, they're like, we're not going to change every now and then if there's no cars going across the intersection.
Got it.
So the fact that she says that the light changed and she was the only person at this intersection, they're like, that feels really weird. And this conflicted with her statement that she didn't see any other cars, so it wouldn't have turned red. So just like the premise of the carjacking just immediately seems suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
And so they search for 9 days. That's how long the search lasts.
Mm-hmm.
And then on November 3rd, 1994, she confesses that it's all made up. That she made it all up. She was convinced that they would find the car and she would be found out, but they didn't, and she just broke down.
So they never were like, we know.
No.
It just was a matter of time before she cracked.
Yeah.
Okay.
We obviously should get into the racial hoax of it all. The fact that this crime happened, she knew exactly what she was doing, and yet she implicated an imaginary black assailant. The fear that she instilled in this community, there were people that in South Carolina...
Very Sherry Papini of her, by the way.
Very Sherry Papini of her. She was doing it first, 1994, might I add. The fear that she instilled in this community, there was footage of people going, I pass by that intersection all the time. I have my kids in the car all the time. The fear that she spread throughout her community, mm-hmm. the racism that she was playing on, this mm-hmm. like boogeyman that she created. It's just sick. It's disgusting. Mm-hmm. What happened was she confessed that she strapped her two kids in her car and she put it on a boat ramp and she just let the car roll down into a nearby lake and she let her kids drown in the car. She will later say that she tried to kill herself along with them. The defense attorneys will say that her body willed her out of the car.
Stop. Which
I do not buy, because I don't know if she was wet when she called the police about the carjacking. Maybe they would have taken note about that.
That makes me so mad. For so many reasons, but like the like killing them and then being like, I really wanted to die with them.
Fuck you.
Then you'd be dead.
Fuck you. The car was located 122 feet from the shore. So they had previously searched the lake that the car was inevitably found in, but they had only searched the 30-foot radius, and this car was 122 feet from the shore. Divers who went down to the scene of the crime to the car, they said that when they were down in the car, they saw a child's hand on the window. She says that at the time they start looking at her background and what would have led her to do something so horrific, so tragic, they find that her and her then husband were on again, off again, had a pretty volatile relationship, and they were both using their kids sort of as leverage against one another, and both of them had affairs, and she was in an affair with a man, Tom Finley, and they found correspondence from him that said that he would be with her, but the kids, he didn't want to have any kids.
It's Diane Downs, too. It's like these women that are like, ugh.
Yeah. I mean, it's like...
Get a divorce and give your husband full custody.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we just covered the case of the familicide. It's the same thing. It's like they have affairs and they just think they can just cut out part of their life and then be done with it.
Mm-hmm.
She will say that she actually had no motive, that she didn't plan these murders, that she wasn't in her right state of mind. Some of her background would suggest that obviously she does have mental health challenges. I don't think that, well, I'll let you decide. Her dad died by suicide when she was just 6 years old, and her first suicide attempt was when she was 13 years old. So she does have a history mm-hmm. of self-harm and of suicidal ideation and attempts. Her mom remarried this guy, Beverly C. Russell Jr., who's a local businessman who, here's a fun fact, he gained notoriety in the South Carolina's Republican Party and Christian Coalition. Are you about to guess what he ends up doing at the home? He molests Susan.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
There's a history of him molesting his stepdaughter, Susan. It starts when she's a teenager. And there's a report that this molestation, this sexual relationship, I mean, this predatory sexual relationship, continues until 6 months before she murders her kids.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Long time. She graduated from high school in 1989. This is 5 years before the murder. And she made a second suicide attempt after her then-married boyfriend ended their relationship. She would then go on to marry the children's father, David Smith, where they had two sons, Michael and Alexander. And like I said, the both of them would have affairs. Both of them would use their kids as pawns in their relationship. So it's pretty clear why she did it. Although she's claiming that, based on the history I laid out, that she had a mental break and she wasn't aware of what she did. And yeah, she wasn't aware of what she was doing. Her trial was in 1995. And in the opening statement, they were claiming she had all these previous troubles and she had severe depression. Like I said, her defense is saying that she tried to take her own life and her body just willed herself out of the car. Her defense had a psychiatrist diagnose her with dependent personality disorder and major depression.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecution will assert that they believe that she was trying to start a new life and her kids were in the way of that and they wanted to give her the death penalty. The jury deliberates for 2.5 hours and they convict her as guilty of murdering her two children, but they did vote against the death penalty. So she was sentenced to two concurrent life terms in prison in 1995 for the murder of her two sons. While she was in jail in the year 2000, so like 5 years later, it came out that she was having sex with two correctional officers in prison.
Mm-hmm.
They were disciplined, they served time themselves, and then they moved her to another institution. And it said in People that no one trusts her alone with a guard, that she spends most of her time in her cell or working her job. But when she's being transported, there's always two guards with her, preferably a male and a female, and she's never alone. So even if she's being transported, they try to bring another prisoner with her. She's now been in prison more than half of her life. And within the prison system, she has a rap sheet. So she's gotten marks for misbehaving. She's used drugs. A lot of people say that the drug use got worse in the second facility that she was in because it was like this addiction or like trying to feed herself from sleeping with these men she's replacing with drug use. There are also self-mutilation records of self-harm while she's in jail. She was made eligible for parole in November of 2024. One of the rules in South Carolina is that once you finish your sentence and you're up for parole, you're up for parole every 2 years. So this mm-hmm. is her first time being up for parole. And her ex-husband, David Smith, the boy's father, was very clear that he did not want her released. He testified that 30 years is not enough time, that she deserves to stay in prison. She wrote a letter.
Hard to disagree.
She wrote a letter that said, "I am the monster. I am not the monster society thinks I am."
Hmm.
In a parole hearing, you have to have the majority of 7 people approve your parole, and she was denied. Apparently, when she was denied parole, it was reported that she threw a tantrum in her cell. She will be eligible again in 2 years. The case is obviously the horrific crime of hurting her children is so unfathomable. in addition to using people's racial prejudice in creating, I mean, it's all just disgusting, right? So that's a famous story of Susan Lee Smith, who is still serving her time in prison and could be up for parole in a year. As an interesting anecdote, because I think we could end on a little bit of humor, in the season 3 premiere of Arrested Development. Did you watch Arrested Development?
Yeah, of course. I love Arrested Development.
Okay, hold on. I'm going to show you. I'm actually going to send you something then. Obviously, I love Arrested Development as well. So don't look at your... Okay, you can look. The season 3 premiere of Arrested Development, The Cabin, there's a flashback scene where Lucille Bluth, having just gone off of her postpartum medication, is watching a news story about Susan Lee Smith.
Jessica Walters, so good. She's so funny, but...
Just because we think we deserve a little bit of a like, okay. So she recently goes off her parts, and so she's watching, in this flashback, she's watching the news story of this woman, you know, finding out that she killed her kids, and it's her drinking a martini just going, good for her, and it's...
Very dark.
Really dark. And Buster is watching it, watching her say that, and it makes him really afraid. Makes him very nervous. And then at the end of the episode, it features Lucille walking away from the car with Buster asleep in the backseat as it rolls into a nearby body of water.
Whoa. You guys, dark. I'm sorry.
That's really dark. But it's, you know, it's important to get context, and obviously that show really took a big swing. And
yeah, all Carrie was actually doing is just giving context to.
So yeah, So that's the story, and also the little moment of Arrested Development, because if you can't laugh, you'll cry.
That's correct.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I have to tell you as a sidebar. So Jordan's birthday was last week, and yeah. I had the distinct pleasure of going out to dinner with her in the city for her first time, like, out. And we went to Shuka in the West Village.
Uh-huh.
It was so fucking good. Was it great? Good. It was good. It's like a middle, it's like Mediterranean, Middle Eastern, like a lot of shared plates. Ugh. It had this whipped feta with pistachio.
Mm.
Ugh. It had labneh with apricot, honey, and chili.
Wow. I'm starving. So that's really hungry. Hitting it for me. All right, let's go eat.
Go eat. Goodbye. Have fun in Denver. Tell the kids I say hi, please.
I will.
Bye.
Bye.